Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. I think in the previous episode, I said we were going to do the D as in Delta section today. And then I realized D doesn't come after E. F comes after E. So we're not doing the D section. We've done D, we've done E, we're doing F today. But before we go through the F section of the L series in the software of Slackware, I want to talk a little bit really quickly about the EPUB thing. I kind of realized I think I had meant to talk about my EPUB process and then got distracted by something and started talking about something else. So just real quick, like what I do for EPUB is I use a tool called XSLT proc, and that processes content from docbook format into, if you have the correct schema, into an EPUB. So XSLT proc sounds a little bit scarier and more intimidating than it actually is. Well, these days, I mean, it is scary and intimidating. XSL, I can't stand XSL. I think it's horrible. I don't know if it could be better. Like, it might have to be as bad as it is. I don't know. It ain't CSS. Let's put it that way. And I would love for it to be more like CSS. But I'm sure that there are lots of very smart people thinking about this kind of stuff, and they have lots of probably great reasons as to why CSS is not suitable for printed fixed size media. So, you know, that's a thing. XSL is tough. Docbook can be tough because that's XML. But these days you have ASCII-Doc, and ASCII-Doc is no more complex than Markdown. And Markdown can honestly be learned in about a minute. And so can ASCII-Doc. I would say that ASCII-Doc might appear to be more complex if you're coming from Markdown. I was coming from Markdown to ASCII-Doc, but also from RST and from XML. So relative to those technologies, ASCII-Doc wasn't very difficult. So it might take, I don't know, a minute and then some referring back to the documentation for a reminder, you know, like a cheat sheet or something for ASCII-Doc. But it is really, really simple. While its goal isn't exactly, like, Markdown seeks to look like plain text. Like, pretend like there literally is no markup here and just make it look natural. ASCII-Doc, I don't think, has that level of, I don't think it has that goal. It's just to be very lightweight in its markup. And so you do have things that aren't quite as, I don't know, I guess, I don't want to say intuitive, but maybe like just natural in ASCII-Doc. Like the easiest example is when you're writing a link in ASCII-Doc, you bizarrely write the link out first and then just append at the end of it with no space between the link and what text you want to contain that link. You just put a square bracket, whatever word you want to hide, you know, as a link, the word or words that you want to hyperlink, and then close square bracket. So you're reading a paragraph, you know, for more information about, or to listen to my podcast, go to http://gnuworldorder.info/gnuworldorder.info/, or I don't know, I guess it would be like, to listen to my http://gnuworldorder.info/podcast/, go to my website, something like that. So podcast is like a hyperlink to http://gnuworldorder.info. But the way that it's actually written out, you know, you're reading along in English, and then suddenly, oh my gosh, there's this URL here. And then at the end of the URL, which feels wrong because I would never type a square bracket into the URL bar of my web browser. So it's, in other words, it feels a little bit unnatural. And I in Markdown, it hides that even better. It sort of alerts you, hey, you're out of English now because we're doing a square bracket, link, close square bracket, parentheses, the word that you want to disguise as a hyperlink, close parentheses. It's got little signs, little signifiers that alert you, hey, stop, you know, get your brain out of English mode and talk tech for a moment and then go back into English. ASCII.doc doesn't do that. So it's a little bit less natural feeling, but it's really very, very simple nevertheless. Now, ASCII.doc, you can compile out to DocBook. That's the cool thing about ASCII.doc. It'll just go straight to DocBook. And then from DocBook, you can do xsltproc --output build/epub, for instance. That would be, you would have a directory called build. And in build, you would have a subdirectory called epub. That's how I structure my build system. So it could be anything. It could be output my epub slash, you know, it doesn't matter. But --output build/epub/, and then space. And this is the path to the XSL. So the XSL needs to be, like, you can get that from docbook.org. Is that their address, docbook.org? Yeah, I'm sure it is. Docbook.org. You can get the schemas, and there's an XSL file there called, or rather for, ebooks, or epubs. So I keep that in the same folder as the thing that I am writing. I don't actually. I symlink to it. But docbook/epub/docbook.xsl. So that's the style page. That's like the CSS file. Space, src/temp.xml. And that is the source XML file that you've generated from your ASCII doc. Again, src source, like, that's just the directory name I give it. And I'm just using tmp temp. .xml, because I don't know what you call your ASCII doc file, but, you know, it could be myfile.xml, mygreatbook.xml, whatever. So that processes your doc book that you've derived from your ASCII doc, and creates the infrastructure for an EPUB. And that infrastructure includes a folder called OEBPS. I looked up what that meant and have completely forgotten since looking it up, but it's got some files that are important to the structure of the EPUB, like content.opf and an index file and so on. So that directory exists and it's within your EPUB directory. And then you do you need a MIME type. You need to define a MIME type. So you can do that. Let me bring up the exact MIME type thing. So it's application/epub+zip. That's the MIME type, application/epub+zip. So if you put that, literally that string, application/epub+zip, that string into a file called MIME type, that'll be the thing that you need to do for the next step. You've got a MIME type file containing the string application/epub+zip. Then you do zip --no-extra. That's to set the no extra, like, file attributes or something. And then -0. That's the compression level. And it means basically zero compression. Do not compress this file, but act like you are. So zip --no-extra --0 --mygreatbook.epub. So here you're creating the file with an EPUB extension --mime-type. So that's the file you just created containing this the MIME type definition. So now you've got an EPUB file containing exactly one file, which is the MIME type. So that basically just tells things that know to look for a MIME type that there is a MIME type to this zip file, and bizarrely, it's not a zip file. I mean, it is a zip file, but don't act like it's a zip file. Instead, act like it's an EPUB file plus zip, and on your system, there will be something, ideally, if you're trying to read an EPUB, you'll have loaded something that's looking for a MIME type of EPUB. So this is for the benefit of your system to see that, oh, this zip file is actually an EPUB, so I'll treat it differently from other zip files. This is the thing that prevents your system from opening up an EPUB just in Arc, as if though it's a zip file, and instead opening it in some appropriate EPUB reader, Ocular, or what's it called? Bookworm, I think, is one of them, and so on. So that obviously, or maybe not obviously, but that doesn't contain anything but a MIME type file. That's not very useful to you. So now you're going to add that OEBPS file and another file that's been generated by XSLT proc, which is meta-inf. So that's just a zip command again, zip space dash dash no dash extra space dash 9. So this time we're doing the full compression. Migrate book.epub or whatever file you've created for your EPUB, dash R for recursive, meta-inf space OEBPS. And that grabs the meta-inf file and everything in the OEBPS folder and zips it up at maximum compression into the file that you've created, that EPUB file. It all gets zipped up. So with zero compression applied, there's MIME type so that anything can recognize this file as an EPUB. And then compressed a lot, there's the actual contents of the EPUB book. That's it. That you've created an EPUB manually. So there's a lot of magic happening there because a lot of that, the heavy lifting is done by XSLT proc. You just use it to apply a schema of EPUB to your XML data, which you've generated from ASCII doc. Couple of levels of magic, but the actual like formation of the EPUB is just a zip file. Okay, so now let's get on to the F as in Foxtrot section, and the first one is FarStream. I don't have a whole lot to say about this. It's a set of libraries, header files and libraries, for streaming applications, media streaming applications, specifically video conferencing. That's the goal. So it's not really intended to, like, it's not a streaming server for, like, music. It is specifically designed for video conferencing, or I guess probably telephony in general. And the library names and header file names kind of reveal that. FS dash, well, candidate, that doesn't really, oh, there we go, conference.h, FS dash transmitter, FS dash session, FS dash RTP, participant, plugin. The SO files are things like libfsrawconference, libfsrtpconference, libfsvid, videoanyrate.so. So it's about video conferencing, and these are going to be really useful for people who are designing a desktop application to do conferencing, video conferencing, through specifically GStreamer libraries, which is kind of the, well, it's one of the all-purpose multimedia libraries for Linux. You've certainly heard of GStreamer if you've been using Linux for any amount of time. It's one of those things that pops up usually at inconvenient times, because you're usually trying to do something media related and you get an error message about you're missing a GStreamer good or GStreamer bad or GStreamer ugly. And those are the names of the library sets. So you've probably seen it in almost a negative context, but I mean, it's actually a fantastic multimedia library. It's really, really useful. You can do a lot of cool things with it, including obviously video conferencing. I don't know that many desktop applications for video conferencing. I feel like that's not really exactly a thing. I'm not saying it shouldn't be a thing. I'm just saying it isn't really a thing. That's not to say that it's literally not a thing. I'm just saying it's not that popular. The online solutions seem to have kind of taken over. But if you go to FlatHub, no, did I mean FlatHub? Yeah, I did. And look up Jitsi, Jitsi. You'll find a Jitsi Meet application, which, I mean, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if it was just an Electron app at this point. Which, I mean, I don't say that disparagingly. I think Electron's amazing, but like it used to be like a GTK application that you could install and in theory use Jitsi over. It never worked for me. Jitsi now works amazingly though. If you just go to Jitsi, well, jit dot meet dot jit dot c, so MEET dot JIT dot SI, you can do an instant video call with whomever you want. Like, you don't have to reserve a room, you don't have to sign up for anything. It's a video call online. It's really, really cool. Jitsi is one of the good ones. It's open source as well, so that's why it's one of the good ones. There's also one called Big Blue Button, which is actually really quite nice as well. I haven't used that as much, although I'll be using it on July 12th, I think, or maybe my 13th, to do a training session on Kdenlive, to give a training session on Kdenlive to a bunch of people. For the Free Software Foundation. So bigbluebutton.org, that's a really good one. It's sort of designed more around a classroom setup. So there's like an instructor, and that instructor has the ability to mute the class or to call on a class member. Students have the ability to raise their hand and so on. So it's quite nice. I just haven't used it quite as much as Jitsi. Jitsi I use literally every week right now. I'm doing some gaming over Jitsi, so that's a weekly thing that I'm using Jitsi for. One I think that's kind of underrated though, is called P2P.chat, and P2P.chat. There we go. And this is a what I think it, what is it? RPC, web RPC, or is it? Now I have RTP in my head, so I want to make everything RTP. But anyway, it's a zero server interface. There's no middle man here. It's computer to computer. Your browser opens up a session with the other person's browser. It's a direct connection. It's really, really clever. P2P.chat is very minimal. It does not have a lot of features. It's almost proof of concept, except it's really, really nice. I mean, you can create a room again instantly. You just name the room something and create the room, and then you invite someone to that room, and then they pop up, and now you're talking over the internet directly to one another. It's pretty neat. Nextcloud has a similar interface to it. Although I will say I've had some weird problems getting people into those chats. It seems like I'll start a Nextcloud chat and invite someone to the call, but they won't be able to, like, they don't pop into my chat, or they do, but not their video. And I can never really determine whether it's my setup or whether they're just not pressing the right buttons, or where the sort of the miscommunication is. But P2P chat, I've had a really, really good experience with. Jitsi and Big Blue Button. There are probably others that I'm not thinking of in terms of open source video conferencing, but those are the three that I can think of. But those are all browser based, right? I mean, those aren't desktop applications. I mean, Jitsi, as I've said, kind of does have a desktop app these days, well, and has had for quite some time. But I end up not ever using it. I just use it in the web browser just because, I don't know, that's what I'm used to at this point, especially, you know, doing conferencing for work and stuff. It's just, you just kind of have, at least I do, I've got everything sort of set up in the browser to just, so that's the work dashboard or set of bookmarks specifically. Yeah, so that's FarStream. And why that ships with Slackware, I don't exactly know. But, I mean, not that everything has to have a reason to ship with Slackware. I mean, really, like, why does EPUB-Tools ship with Slackware? Like, there's no other bigger application that depends on EPUB or ebook, ebook-tools, and yet it's there. FarStream, I don't know that anything depends on those libraries that's installed, but it's there, and that's reason enough sometimes. It's just something cool. Maybe it's something you'd like to mess around with. Well, here it is on Slackware. Next in line is FFmpeg. I could go on for forever about FFmpeg. As I've said before, probably in the past on the show, FFmpeg was literally the application that that really got me into open source. I mean, I attribute that to a lot of different applications, to be honest. Like, Audacity was an early application that I used without ever understanding that it was open source. I just knew that that was an audio recorder that you could get for free on the internet. And so, you know, back then I probably called it, like, I don't know, shareware or freeware or something like that, not understanding the significance sort of, like, of it being open source. But FFmpeg came around to me at a time when I was starting to understand the significance of it being open source. And I found FFmpeg as a really, really bad Mac OS X application called, I think, FFmpeg X or something like that. And it was just this horrible attempt. I mean, noble attempt, but, like, looking back at it, you know, it's just like, oh boy, that's painful. But it was a noble attempt by someone to give a GUI to FFmpeg. And I struggled with the GUI for quite some time, thinking it was probably useless and pointless. And the more I researched FFmpeg, the more I realized that it was actually really, really powerful, and that the thing that was getting in my way was the GUI. And I want to say that quite possibly the first thing that I kind of learned to do in a terminal was to use FFmpeg, because you could go into the package that you downloaded for Mac OS X, and there was just this binary of a compiled FFmpeg in the package. So I just literally just dragged that out of the package and used the binary of FFmpeg from a terminal to convert videos. And I, because I knew how to do that, I was able to earn money, like rent money, food money for myself, by converting videos for people in the film business who couldn't edit the footage that their cameras were providing them in their video editor of choice, which at the time was Final Cut Pro. And Final Cut Pro was just very staunchly, in typical Apple fashion, staunchly under the illusion that the only thing that existed in the world was Apple-sanctioned video codecs. So the fact that FFmpeg was able to take some weird, I think it was actually X264, to be perfectly honest. I think there was a time, and I could be misremembering, but I think there was a time when Final Cut Pro couldn't parse X264 or H264 video. So I would take that and then translate it into a QuickTime movie for people, and they would then be able to edit it in their Apple computer in their Apple software. And that was a service that I provided, like I say, for money, earned actual rent money with that knowledge. And this was around the same time that I had discovered, like, Tetris in Emacs and the GPL. And so it all started to kind of coalesce around that time. So FFmpeg is a big deal for me for that reason, like sentimental reasons, bizarrely. But it's also a big deal because it's just such a useful application, and I could do a whole episode on FFmpeg really, really easily. Like, I mean, there's no way to overstate its flexibility. Like, it's just such a powerhouse. If you do a man page, or if you do a man FFmpeg pipe T pipe PR, then it formats the man page into sort of a, in theory, printable, paginated output. And I've got 33 pages by its count. It's 33 pages. I mean, it could be more, I don't know, but that's what it's telling me, is 33 pages. So there's a lot here. At its most basic, FFmpeg can, it converts, right? That's what it does. And I think in theory, the syntax is pretty darn easy. It's FFmpeg dash I for input, and then some input. Let me find some test footage here. Here's some clouds. Cloud flyover dot MOV. So that's input is that, and then the rest of your command is specifying various aspects of the output that you want. So a lot of times that might be something like, maybe there's no audio, or maybe there is audio, but you want to drop it. So that might be, for instance, dash A in for audio, no. If you wanted to, I don't know, get just the audio from this stream, then it could be dash V in, as in video, no. So I'm going to do A in for audio, no. Then maybe there's something like, I don't know, the codec that you want to use. Although, honestly, you don't even have to do that lately. You can pretty much just provide the output. So I'll put that in my temporary directory, and I'll call it test dot webm, just for kicks. Oh, and I'm going to actually, before that, I'm going to do dash threads 6, so that I'm threading this ideally quite a bit. Now, you can also do other things like specify the size, a new size of video. Before you do that, you might need to investigate what size this video is in the first place, really. So maybe there would have been a step before that. And there's a tool for that called FF Probe. FF Probe tells you, just analyzes a media file and dumps all of the information that it can extract or divine about that media file to your terminal. It's a very, very useful tool. So I'll just do FF Probe videos, stock footage. Here's a different cloud movie. I just grabbing random things here. Billowing clouds. So that's a major brand, is Qt. So, or no, it's not Qt. Qt, QuickTime. The minor version, compatible brands. Here's the duration, 12 seconds. That's correct. It's just a little stock footage. Here is the encoder, photo JPEG. So not great. Bit rate. Stream is 00 is English, video MJPEG, JPEG YUVJ 422p. So that's the format. 1920 by 1080 is the size. So there's the 1920 by 1080. So that's good. Let's see if my WebM is done. It is. Okay. So I'm gonna do an LL of my temporary directory. And look at how big this file is. File size of test.webm is 4.0. Four megabytes. And the size of the QuickTime movie source is 202 megabytes. And that's why you really ought to consider using WebM. WebM is an amazing format. 4 megabytes versus 202 megabytes. And yes, one's a lot. I've shaved off a lot of I'm sure quality or something from WebM, but I mean honestly, to look at it, it's just amazing. It looks great. So that's the syntax, ffmpeg dash I, your input, and then all the options that you want for your output. Now, again, before you decide upon your output, you probably really do want to know about your input. So don't forget to actually investigate what your input, what you're getting from your input file. FFPROBE will give you the information. I will say it's not the most beautiful output format. There's something called Media Info that can do this a lot sort of prettier for you. And it just flat out labels things better. I mean, it's not a matter of being pretty. It's just a matter of being explicit, really. Media Info is not in Slackware, but it is on slackbuilds.org, so you can compile it. I think there's a GUI for it as well, but I never use that. I just do Media Info and then the path to the video. And it gives you all the same information. It just tells you what it is. So, for instance, general is complete name. Okay, that's the path. Format MPEG-4. Format profile QuickTime. Codec ID QT 2005.03. File size, it just gives it to you right there, 201 megabytes, which is a megabyte among friends. Duration, 12 seconds, 346 milliseconds. Overall bit rate is variable, but the overall bit rate itself is 137 megabits per second. Encoded date is 2009. Tagged date, writing library, Apple QuickTime. Video ID 1, format JPEG, duration, blah, blah. Here's the width 1 space 920 pixels, height 1 space 080 pixels. I'm assuming the space is just a missing comma or something. The display aspect ratio 16:9, frame rate mode is constant. The frame rate is 29:97. So I mean, and it goes on and on. So it gives you a lot of information. That's super useful information. That's the kind of stuff that you want to look at before you convert something, just to make sure that you're doing something that's actually going to save you space or that's going to preserve quality or whatever your goal is. Media Info or FF Probe, if you can't be bothered, do you have Media Info? That's an important step. That's an important first step. So FFmpeg, then you can make choices about what you want to do with that input file. So again, if the goal is to just save some space, then maybe you want to just re-encode, a particularly large file that was recorded on your phone down to something a lot smaller, like a WebM file. In which case, you can do that just by specifying an output file ending in .webm. Now that's a VP9 codec, so if you needed for some reason to specify that specifically, you can. You can do a dash V colon C or C colon V. I'm going to find out, I guess. And that's going to be libvp9. It looks like it's codec dash C colon V. Oh, libvp9 is not a valid library. Okay, there we go. Okay, so the final command, in case you ever need to explicitly define what library you want to use for encoding, you can specify that with a dash C for codec colon either A for audio or V for video, and then tell it the library that you want to use. That's a little bit awkward. I've always found that specifying, like finding the right name for the library seems to be a little bit difficult. I think FFmpeg could probably do a better job of making that easier. Now, you can get the configuration of, I mean, like you, FFmpeg tells you its configuration pretty easily. It's not hard to get that. You can just do FFmpeg, just type FFmpeg. It gives you the version, and then it tells you everything that you compiled this with. So it just literally shows you the options, like dash dash mander equals user man, dash dash Enable shared dash dash disable static dash dash enable GPL dash dash enable AV resample dash dash enable FreeOR dash dash enable dash OpenAL dash dash enable dash lib opus and so on. It goes on and on and on. And this is my own build. Is it actually? This might be the official Slackware build, because I used to go to great lengths to compile FFmpeg myself. But now, I think as of this time, I might have just gotten away with using Pat's version, and it looks like I did. So that's kind of interesting. For a while, I was compiling it myself because I just wanted literally everything in FFmpeg. But lately, my workflows have become a lot more predictable, and it just doesn't pay for me to make sure that I have literally every codec that I can find in FFmpeg. And if ever I get video footage that just for some reason needs to be converted and I can't figure out how to convert it, then I'll recompile FFmpeg. It's not that big of a deal. So it does list all the things that are enabled. But for instance, for VP9, the option was dash dash enable dash lib VPX. But the library that you want to reference when converting using VP9 is not VPX, it's VP9. Or if you want to convert using VP8, then it's dash C colon V VP8 instead of VP9. So that feels a little bit, that's always been a little bit unsteady. And I always, I'm always getting it wrong. It'll be like dash V or dash C colon A Vorbis. Oh no, not Vorbis, lib Vorbis. So it's one of those things where it's always what you don't think it is. It's always the second thing that you try. And I'm making that up. It could be, maybe it is Vorbis and not lib Vorbis. I don't know. But the point is that I always think it's the other one. AAC often, I think, gives me problems as well. I think because I have FDK underscore AAC installed. And so I have to use that. But if you don't use that, then you might be using FAAC or FAAD. Well, it would be FAAC for this. So yeah, it's very difficult to know really what you're supposed to feed FFmpeg. Now, there's another way to find out what's available in theory on your system, and that's FFmpeg-format, or is it formats, plural, formats, yeah, dash formats, not dash dash, just dash, dash formats. And that gives you a big long list, like screenfuls and screenfuls of all the different formats that are available on your system. But again, it doesn't tell you what magical incantation to use to get there. So you can see that you have access to WebM. If you look around enough, UVW, there we go. WebM underscore chunk. I've got E and D E and E by all of, or yeah, E E D E by those. So that's encoder, and then one of them, the WebM dash manifest, has a decoder and encoder. So I've got all that stuff. It's just I don't know how, or you might not know how to get there. Now, luckily, I think FFmpeg has gotten a lot better at just detecting the ending, the file ending. So certainly WebM, WebP, AUG, those things, like it just kind of knows what encoder to use. But if you're doing something a little bit more fiddly, like an M4V or M4A or MP4, you want to use something specific. Maybe you want to use XVID instead of 264 or something like that. Then it can get kind of tricky. But that's the basics of FFmpeg, and I think that's probably sufficient. FFmpeg dash I for input, the thing that you want to convert, and then all of the output options. And that's, I guess, where it gets tricky, because there's a lot of output options. There are filters you can send it through, the media through, and for processing. before it gets written to file. There's just a whole bunch of things that you can do with FFmpeg. I'm going to assume that a lot of people mostly care about file size because that's, in my experience, that's usually what people are trying to do. So the main things there are the image size, like the quote unquote physical size, the pixel count. It's probably not all that surprising to you to hear that 1920 by 1080 is on average going to be almost as, twice as much file size as like a 720 by 960 image. It's because one is double the other. And so ultimately, one is going to, the other one's going to be bigger, the other one's going to be smaller. So that's a thing that happens. The other thing is the audio. You'd be surprised about how much of your sort of budget, as it were, the audio takes up. You have uncompressed audio in a video or several audio streams in a video, then your video is going to be bigger. And technically the video isn't, but that file containing your video and audio certainly is. And that's because you might have like Dolby AC3 as well as a M4A and maybe some other language streams in there as well. So you've got like possibly, two, three, four audio streams all embedded within the same container file as your single video. And if you were to extract just the video and maybe just one of those streams, or maybe you extract one of those streams and then you compress that stream and then you put the video and the audio back into a container together, then you've got a smaller file. So those are the two major things. It's your audio and the pixel count of your video. Also the length, usually a 2 hour or 90 minute movie file is going to be larger than a 30-second clip. You can control the endpoints and the outpoints in FFmpeg with the dash SS for start and dash 2, like TO, options, and those both take timestamps. So you might do dash SS00 colon 01 colon 00 to start about a minute in. And then maybe you want to go until, I don't know, the 5 minute mark. So you do dash TO00 colon 06 colon 00 because you've started at one, you want to go to the 5 minute mark. So you have to go 5 minutes forward for a total of, to the 6 minute point, actually. That was confusingly said. I said 5 minute mark. So I guess, okay, so 5 minute mark would be 00 colon 04 colon 00 because now you're already one in. So you go four more and now you're at the 5 minute mark there. If you wanted 5 minutes of video, then you would have done from one to six. And you can whittle that down to the millisecond, which gets a little bit confusing because video usually talks in frames. But frames aren't really a thing, so FFmpeg usually talks in milliseconds. That's a little bit clunky. That's tough, but you can do math and figure things out if you really need to. But frames are kind of an illusion anyway. It's really a film convention. Video streams don't really understand what that is. I mean, we put it there, we forced it upon it, but it's not really a thing. So there's all of that, and then there's a bunch of, like I say, a bunch of other things that you can control, like the quality of the audio, the bit rate, the whether something is a constant bit rate or a variable bit rate. And that's a really, really nice feature because in a video stream, you can tell FFmpeg to keep the entire video at a constant rate of bit data. Or you can allow it to use its own judgment and be a little bit sparser on video frames that don't move a lot. Like if it's just a talking head and mostly Their head is bobbing back and forth a little bit, but mostly it's just their mouth moving. You don't really need a lot of bit rate for that. Like the background isn't changing. Maybe it is just around their head as they move, but most of the image, you can just recycle pixels from the previous frame. So if you set your movie to be a constant bit rate though, then it's going to be constant quality no matter what. It's going to be refreshing those pixels every frame no matter what, or every other frame, or whatever bit rate you've set. Whereas if it's a variable bit rate, then it can find those areas that don't require a lot of refreshed pixels and cheat those places so that it can then refresh all the more during the big action scene with the explosions and the lasers and the laser swords and the spaceships and things that are moving around. So there are lots of little tricks, and the best way to learn them, and every movie is different. Every file is different. So when you're encoding, the thing that you learned yesterday on the documentary with people just talking about, I don't know, Fermat's last theorem, everything you learned on that, you're going to throw out the window tomorrow when you're encoding the big action sci-fi movie. Because they'll want completely different things. You'll be able to cheat in different ways on both of those two things. And so the best way to explore all of the different options available in FFmpeg is to encode video. Just encode video. If you want to learn FFmpeg and get a feel for what all these different options do, every night, just encode a video. First, encode the same video lots of different ways. Do it at different resolutions, do it at different bit rates, do it with different filters applied. Just do lots of different things. And different filters, of course, apply differently to different codecs as well. So there's that. A lot of the fancy FFmpeg commands you see in a lot of places, like in Handbrake and even Kdenlive, Live, a lot of those are they're there because they have to be there for the codec that's being used, like X264. Like you've got a lot of control, for better or for worse, over your iframes and your B frames and your P frames and things like that. Maybe you don't even want that. Maybe you don't need that. Maybe the codec that you want to go out to doesn't bother with that. And so maybe your command for WebM is going to be a lot simpler than your X264 command. That's okay, because I mean, frankly, WebM is the superior codec between those two, so you might as well just go with WebM. But I mean, if for whatever reason you need to go to X264, then obviously you might want to learn the different little filters available for that. But the point is, encode lots of video. Encode the same video over and over and over and over with different settings. See what that does. Sometimes it won't do anything. You won't notice a difference, and that's good. Like that's important to notice. And then start doing different video files at those different settings, and see how, the rolling cloud stock footage differs from the gently swaying dandelions in the breeze footage. Like those will be two different. Those will react differently. Daylight shots versus dark night shots, those are going to be different. For a very long time on like Netflix and streaming services that people pay for, if you looked in the dark regions, like the shadowy regions on a lot of shots, you'd see all this digital noise. And every time I would see it, I would just cringe. And I know exactly what they did, to accidentally end up with that kind of those artifacts in their encoding, but it's painful to see, and you think, yep, that's exclusively because they didn't they did a batch job of a bunch of different movies for probably maybe a different for a specific quality or a specific size file size, and they didn't take into account that this needs more latitude in its colors than, the other movie that takes place all during the day, really, really brightly lit, not a big deal. So FFmpeg, very, very powerful, very, very complex. But to start with it, it's very, very simple. FFmpeg-i for input, the input file, and then really, honestly, the output file. that'll do it. Like a different codec or a different format for your output file. See what happens. See what FFmpeg does for you, and then start adding different. Try different codecs. Try different options. Look at the man page. Just try different settings. It'll get frustrating because a lot of the settings, like I say, don't work universally. So you'll think, well, why did I try that? It's not even going. Well, try something different. Yeah, that's it. That's FFmpeg. I talked about that really a lot longer than I think I meant to, but as I've said, I'm a big fan of FFmpeg. That is one of the deciding factors for what distribution I use. Like one of the reasons I love Slackware is because I can control what version of FFmpeg I use very, very easily. I can control how it gets compiled. And on a lot of other distributions, trying to compile FFmpeg yourself is just an exercise in frustration because you have to build the package for FFmpeg, and then that's going to depend on a lot of other packages, even though it might not actually depend on other packages. So then you have to adjust that, and it goes on and on and on, and it's horrible. Slackware, it's easy. You download the source code, you figure out your configuration options, you make sure that you've got all the libraries that you want to compile against installed, and then you go and it compiles it and you install it and you're on your way. And that's what I would do, every new Slackware release for a very long time. And like I said, Slackware 15, I think, is the first time I've bothered not doing that, which feels a little bit crazy because it is such an important application. But sometimes I think the way that it gets compiled in Slackware is just happens to coincide with the way that I like it to be compiled, and lately it's been working for me, so I have not bothered. And that's great. That's fantastic. I want that. That is really good. That's FFmpeg. We did not get through the whole F section, unfortunately. But that's okay because there's not a whole lot left. There's about a screen full of F as in Foxtrot applications, FFTW, FluidSynth, FreeCell, FreeType, FreeOR. So lots of cool multimedia related things that I'm very excited to talk about, but I'm not going to do it right now. I'll do it next episode instead. And then we'll get on to whatever comes after F in the alphabet. Who knows? Could be D, could be G. We'll find out. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.